From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this very special 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. If you followed our programs, you know that our normal format is to have a guest from the older and the middle and the younger generation for each of our topics that we do. And from time to time, and by the way, this is the third that we've done it this way in 13 years, I do come across a guest who has written or is focused on a topic that really sheds light on all of our generations, both the living generations and those from the past. And this evening's program is just one such topic like that. And let me also tell you that this will be part one, and next week we'll conclude with part two. But if you'd like to hear the entire interview, if you can't wait that long, you can go to the podcast, which is at our website at yttshow.org, and it's also going to be on iTunes. In recent years, we've seen and we've heard much about the polarization, the red and the blueness of our society. And we think that it didn't used to be so strained and strident. And in fact, a couple hours ago, just before I left to come up to do the program today, I overheard a conversation between a couple of people in the store. And they were talking about how in their youth, when they were growing up, we weren't as we are now, that things used to be a lot more American. I knew what I was coming up against here today in discussing this book. And I know that it's not quite that way. And our author will tell you a little bit more. My special guest this evening is author Colin Woodard, whose recent book has fascinated me in how it relates not only to the historical nature of our divergent cultures, but also to the current and the future attitudes that we have about each other today even. American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America is the book, and it's published by Penguin Books, and Colin Woodard joins us from his home in Portland, Maine. Colin, welcome to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
Colin Woodard is a writer, a historian, and award-winning journalist who has reported for the Chronicle for Higher Education, and his work has appeared in The Economist, Smithsonian, the San Francisco Chronicle, The Washington Post, Newsweek, The Daily Beast, and many more publications. And he's also the author of Lobster Coast, The Republic of Pirates, and Ocean's End. Colin, I want to begin the program with you today talking about what I just mentioned a second ago about this conversation I heard. And I know in your book you speak about the difference between the myth of what we've been taught over the generations of how we came together as a unified country. And in fact, it may be a little bit different than that. And I'd also want to mention that as our program is broken up into two parts, I want to spend the first portion of our program talking about the 11 regions and have you discuss with us how they impact those generations of that time, how people were then, how the regionalization was. Again, it's a fascinating book, and I want to give you all the time in the world to tell us more about what we should know, really, about the various parts of our country.
My pleasure. The short answer is that there's never really been one America, but several Americas, and their rival cultural traditions and their answers to the great American questions about what is the American identity and what are the real American ideals and the intents for the country, they each have their own answers. And sometimes those answers aren't compatible, and they actually are the background that fuel some of our most fiery and ever-recurring debates over things like, you know, what's the real meaning of liberty or freedom? Or are we an Anglo-Protestant nation that immigrants should assimilate into some kind of Anglo-Protestant dominant culture that we supposedly have? Or are we a mosaic of different cultures and people bringing things from different parts of the world that can coexist side by side? Now, those are all legitimate American ideals, but each of them comes from a different regional culture. So that's the ultimate thesis in the book, and that these regional cultures date back to the early colonial period when the first clusters of colonies were being settled by entirely disparate groups of people.
Well, I was even fascinated about prior to that, how our common thought sometimes is that it all happened at Plymouth Rock, but you actually speak about how there was a lot going on way before that.
Oh, yeah. Not only before Plymouth Rock, but I think the great disservice in our history, at least, you know, I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, and when I, in public school, learned our history, it sort of went something along the lines of hey, the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, and fast forward to the French and Indian War in the 1760s. And sort of like, what happened to that century and a half in between? And there's very little attention paid to the colonial period other than the sort of quick, Thanksgiving Day kind of, powwow with the Indians, and then you rush forward to the revolutionary period. And I think the reason is that it's a messy and bizarre story, and the story of the colonial period is nothing like most Americans would expect it to be, because it doesn't really feed into a national narrative. As the more you learn about the colonial period, the more unlikely it seems that we actually managed to come together as one united and indeed very successful and very powerful continent-spanning country, because that was perhaps the least likely development from the colonial period, its history, and the very different countries that were founded along the eastern seaboard and indeed the southwestern rim of the country in the colonial period that didn't see themselves as all being involved in one national enterprise to create a new country, but indeed saw each other as rivals and often even enemies and fighting on the opposite sides of major conflicts from one another.
Well, now we're recording our program here today in Little Rock, Arkansas, kind of in the middle of the country. And if we could have recorded this program 100 years ago or 200 years ago, the population would be entirely different than it is today. We have a great number of people from all different parts of the country. Those of you listening to the program today, if you could have the opportunity to see the cover of the book, you would see the map. It doesn't even look like the United States in state form. It's in regional form. A very interesting way to begin the book. And also, Colin, if you would, can you take us through the 11 regions kind of briefly and focus on the ones you think are more important to how we are, how we've come to be? Those of you listening to the program, you might identify as he speaks of where you came from, where your ancestors came from, and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. I mean, today there are 11, and 9 of them date back to the early colonial period. 2 others are much younger and are the creations of people moving from other regional cultures or nations, as I call them. But the way to do it briefly, I suppose, is the most powerful 2 today. One is what I call Yankeedom, which is the greater New England cultural space, which, of course, started with the Puritan migration to Massachusetts Bay and extended across, well, first New England, of course, but then continued along much of upstate New York, which was claimed by Massachusetts and the settlement of which was conducted by Massachusetts-based land companies, diverting entire townspeople traveling with their missionaries to form new New England-style settlements. And the same with the Western Reserve of Ohio, which was the Western Reserve of Connecticut, which was the top northern tier of Ohio, which has completely different political behavior than the southern parts of Ohio, and on into the northern bits of Illinois and most of the upper Great Lakes states. Those are all places that were founded either by their New Englanders or people of New England background who come from upstate New York or the Western Reserve of Ohio. And the argument is that as they came to those places, usually in the early part of the 19th century, they ended up sort of setting the cultural DNA down, creating the institutions and societal norms and legal standards and assumptions that everybody else ended up encountering when they came later. The first settlers and territorial governors and people laid and set the tone and created the dominant culture that the rest of us ended up encountering and kind of had to deal with as a accomplished fact on the ground, like it or not, and that the characteristics of that culture have endured. The same for the other colonial clusters as you work down the eastern seaboard. They each had their own beachhead and cultural characteristics early on, and then each spread generally east to west into mutually exclusive bands of settlement, in part because they were actually avoiding one another, because they often found it difficult to live together and were sending word back to the eastern seaboard about advice on whom to settle among and where to go. And again, these settlement bands don't usually match state boundaries. There's a separate culture clustered around what's now New York City that was actually settled by the Dutch and was a commercial trading society from the very beginning and had very different characteristics from its earliest creation, but ones that are recognizably the Big Apple. From the time it was a tiny village, it was multi-ethnic and multi-religious and had a an enormous emphasis placed on tolerance and diversity of opinion, and not a lot on, you know, big moral questions like should you own slaves or not. That wasn't ever part of the major agenda there. And you work your way a little bit further south, you know, it's an area called the Midlands, which starts around Philadelphia, southern New Jersey, the Delaware Valley. It was founded by Quakers, so William Penn's great experiment. And the Quakers believed that humans were inherently good. They had an inner light. And one of the policy outcomes of that is that they had a fairly open-door policy in the colonial period towards immigration. Anybody could come in, sure, you know, come settle next to us because we think everyone's inherently good. And so from the very beginning, they had people from all over Europe settling there. Pennsylvania, at the time of the Revolution, was the only supposedly British colony that that people of British descent were in a minority there. It had a German majority in 1776. And that sort of idea, the Midland idea that the genius of the United States is that you would have a mosaic of cultures living side by side, that sort of pluralism idea, which is the antithesis of the Yankee interpretation, which is no, that we're an Anglo-Protestant culture and that others may come here, but they're supposed to become like us, that it's a melting pot. Henry Ford's melting pot ideas in Yankee Michigan were applied on the immigrants who came to work in his factories, who literally were brought to attend schools where they would learn to behave more like Americans, in quotes, but really more like Yankees. I mean, that was the model there, the opposite of the Midlands model. So you can see the contradictions you might have even between those two cultures living side by side. You work further down the eastern seaboard, so we have Yankeedom and New Netherland and the Midlands, and then you get down to the area around the Chesapeake, which was also founded very early. That's called the Tidewater. That's the origins of early colonial Virginia, and it was settled in the early 1600s, just as Yankeedom was, but by a completely different group of people. New England and Yankeedom were founded by the Puritans, these radical Calvinists who were there to create a religious utopia, who believed themselves to be God's chosen people and have a covenant with God. And so they also believed that you could and should try to make the world a better place and more godly here and now. It's literally a utopian vision. They did that through public institutions. The idea is you'd show up and you could create a better world through, you know, your town government and your town meeting hall and the congregational church, and they were trying to perfect the world. There's a more of an emphasis and a belief that government can do good and that public institutions can do good in Yankeedom that goes on to this day. Go down to the Tidewater in the Chesapeake. It was, although another English colony, was founded by a completely different group of people with totally different and alien values from the New England settlement stream. The Tidewater was effectively settled by the younger sons of English gentry, of the sort of, you know, the lords of the great manors in the English countryside. Their firstborn children would inherit the manors back in England. Your second and third and fourthborn sons were out of luck. But when America was discovered, many of them came to early Virginia and tried to recreate the manorial system, the sort of semi-feudal system of the English countryside they'd left behind, creating their own estates with great success. They were attempting to recreate, I guess, what you might call a late 17th century version of Downton Abbey, you know, where there would be a ruling aristocracy who would benignly rule over the rest of society for the rest of society's own good, because these were the most capable people. And so you had a society that was much more hierarchical, with not a lot of concern for equality and broad civic participation, but the sort of sense of that there's a nobility who has duties to society, and society should obey them in return. So it's a very different setup than early New England. Middle-class people coming who were trying to create institutions to prevent the creation of an aristocracy. To the New Englanders, that was the tyranny they'd left behind, and that they were going to have town meetings in every single little town, having sort of control and having its own tiny republics, precisely so that you wouldn't have a landed aristocrat show up to lord over them. So you can imagine those two societies in the early colonial period were fire and ice. They had very little in common. You go a little bit further south and you'd hit a very different southern lowland society, which I call the Deep South, which I think everyone recognizes has different characteristics than the Upper South, and that's founded around Charleston by a generation or two later than Tidewater, Virginia was, and by yet another very distinct group of people. It wasn't founded by the lesser sons of English gentry from England. It was founded by slave lords from the English colony of Barbados in the West Indies, who already had a perfected slave society, you know, with chain gangs and the whole lot to grow sugar. And they had come to what became Charleston and Carolina to recreate a West Indies slave society in the 1660s, you know, sort of stranded in the subtropical lowlands of the American continent. Indeed, in the early days, it was called Carolina in the West Indies, and almost in all the maps and all the correspondence. And that is indeed the society that they created. It was very concentrated power and oligarchy with not a lot of Tidewater-like concern about the duties of the grantums to their tenants, but rather the society was organized to serve the planters at the very top. And you might ask yourself, how could that possibly be compatible with the sort of democratic republic that we think of in America? It's because they thought of it very much as being compatible, because the model they were going for was the model of the democracies of classical antiquity, of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, which were slave societies where only a tiny minority had the privilege of practicing democracy, and the majority had few rights, or indeed often no rights at all, many of whom were actually slaves. That's a very different idea than, say, the Yankee interpretation, which is an old Anglo-Saxon German idea of being a freeborn people. People are born free if you're from the right group of people, and should, you know, nobody should be able to step on those rights. That's also shared by a lot of the Scots and the like. So you have two very different interpretations right there of what freedom meant from the beginning, with very different policy outcomes. So we've been down the Eastern Seaboard, right, and one of the most powerful cultures and one of great consequence today, and which spans a good half of your state, of Arkansas, is what I call Greater Appalachia. And that extends through much more than just Appalachia itself. It started in the behind the Quakers' Midland colonies. Remember I said that the Quakers had let people and immigrants come in large numbers from the very beginning into their colony. Well, one group of people who came in huge numbers were people from the war-torn borderlands of Britain, many of them from the lowlands of Scotland, or from Ulster in Northern Ireland, or from the English Marches, places and cultures that had been formed in a state of centuries of brutal warfare and anarchy, where you often couldn't count on government or the rule of law to protect you and your own. You had to protect your own kith and kin yourself. And it's literally the culture of, you know, the movie Braveheart. Those are the lowland Scots that Mel Gibson was leading into battle. And they went to the frontier areas, into the highlands, both because that was familiar to them in terms of their agricultural strategies and drive being pastoral society rather than an agricultural one, but also because the warlike peoples of the coast wanted them there to serve as literally a buffer against the Native American inhabitants, who were often quite justly upset with the way things were turning out on the continent. So they were sort of brought to the borderlands to secure the borderlands and be sort of the disposable people on the frontier for the wealthier communities along the coast. But that ended up being a huge number of people, and they spread all the way down the chain of the Appalachian Mountains and on into the Ozarks, and indeed out into the hill country of Texas and even on to Oklahoma, spreading a very different culture that prides itself, and I mentioned it's sort of a warrior culture, but also a culture that puts enormous emphasis on individual sovereignty and individual freedom. From their context, freedom means there, most of all, to maximize the individual's freedom from restraint. They don't like tyrants either, like New Englanders, because they don't want anyone messing with their freedom, but they also don't want government or public institutions to be getting in their way. They want to be free of both, which has put them at different times in their history at odds with both the Yankees and the Deep Southerners in some of the big conflicts. For instance, speaking of there being multiple Souths, Appalachia was basically with the Union in the Civil War, unlike Tidewater and the Deep South. It's only during Reconstruction, when the Yankees went to the occupied Deep South and Tidewater and Appalachia and tried to remake it in the Yankee image, and that brought an enormous amount of resistance, particularly in Appalachia, that would later lead to what we consider the South today. Appalachia, that culture, extends, of course, to many places that were never in the Confederacy, to the western part of Virginia, which indeed broke off from Virginia to stay in the Union, during the early days of the Civil War, to Kentucky, which never left, and indeed to the southern tiers of what we consider northern states of Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, I mean, which explains the upstate and downstate Illinois cleavages and so on and so forth. Those are the big cultures of the Eastern Seaboard.
The question that comes to mind in terms of the Revolution is, how in the world did these very divergent groups of people, there's several of them you've mentioned, not mentioning the West yet, how come they even bothered to have a revolution? How did they do it?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And the reason is that they all suddenly faced a shared external threat that forced them all to band together for each of their individual survivals as separate cultures and being able to rule themselves. And that threat was coming from London and from the effort by Britain to form a homogenous and centralized and more authoritarian empire. The kings of Britain wanted and envied Louis XIV in France and having his centralized empire, whatever the king says goes, and having colonies just, you know, follow the imperial lead. In the 1770s, and they moved to try to consolidate their empire and to remove the local control and local cultural differences and peculiarities, and to do so by force and forced taxation. And the threat to each of these separate regional cultures was existential, and it led them all to band together with one another, some of them reluctantly. I mean, in the Deep South, there was a great deal of concern in both lowland Georgia and South Carolina, and actually leaving. But in the end, you had a group of the cultures band together for survival. Now, not all of them did, by the way. In Appalachia, it was very broken and fractured on almost a community and county level where people's allegiances lay. And it all had to do with who did they see as the greatest threat to their freedom and autonomy. Their neighbors in the regional cultures on the coast, be they the Tidewater lords or the deep southern ones, or Britain itself. And different places had different answers to that. The Midlands tried to stay pacifist and stay out of it altogether. They didn't want to see the British Empire collapse. And New Netherland, the area around New York, remained royalist throughout the war and was the base and center of operations from which the Royal Navy and the Army operations were conducted against the American rebels in both directions, and remained, it was the last stand of royalists throughout the Revolution, and would be the last place that everyone would flee to as the British position fell apart late in the war. And there'd be this sort of massive, you know, escape from Saigon, exodus of fleets of vessels abandoning the city at the last moment, going to Nova Scotia and England and elsewhere as the tens of thousands of royalists would flee later. Even in the American Revolution, these cultures were sometimes taking different sides. But those who did support putting an end to the empire were doing so because they all found themselves facing a common threat. They sort of came together at first as a sort of NATO-like alliance, you know, trying to work together with a shared cooperative military force, the Continental Army, and was sort of an alliance to support the Continental Army of separate sovereign states. And that proved to be so clumsy because nobody could force any sovereign state to, you know, cough up manpower or send supplies at any time, that they realized that they wouldn't be able to survive that way. That led to the abandonment of our first loose Articles of Confederation, this sort of loose alliance of separate states, into not a nation state, but a federation with closer ties in the 1780s.
Well, did they think it was going to last? If they saw that the end of the Revolution was coming and there was going to be success, did they think it was going to last as a union of these colonies, or what was really happening after the war?
Well, remember, we're a federation. It's not a national government. We talk about a federal government even today. And there was enormous emphasis in the discussions of the second constitution, of the one we have now, the 1789 constitution, to make sure that the individual states were sovereign and controlled any powers that weren't devolved to the federal government. And that was all intentional because at that time, most of what they considered to be the states were dominated by one regional culture or the other. It wouldn't be for long. They'd lose some control, but for instance, you know, somewhere like North Carolina, the Deep Southern and Tidewater planters controlled the seat in the local legislative bodies, and they intentionally didn't give proper representation to the Appalachian people living in the mountains because they were considered uncouth and unimportant, even though the Appalachian people may have outnumbered them. So there was a at the time, each of the regional cultures could assume that the states were analogous to their regional ways of doing things. And so when they came together to try to create some sort of document, the big battle was over how much power those individual places would have and the characteristics of some of that power. You know, there's all these strange aristocratic inflections in our Constitution. I mean, remember that we people didn't get to elect the president in the beginning. Indeed, technically, we don't. There was this electoral college, this aristocratic institution in between. We also, for a long period of time, didn't get to elect our senators. They were appointed by state legislatures. So that was, again, an effort to make sure that they sort of had a House of Lords, that the proper people would hand things out. Those are all things that were brought forward from the Deep South and Tidewater to protect their traditions. So all over the place, even in our constitutional document, you can see the difficult and sometimes clumsy compromise that had to be put together between the different cultures and their assumptions about what the proper way was, and the original intents of each of these cultures were different. So we got a strange document put forward.
But my question from a generational perspective is, understanding these various cultures that were around to fight this Revolutionary War, were they split up at all in generations? Were the older people the ones who had to run the whole thing and the younger people resisted? Do you know anything about that aspect of younger versus older?
If you think of all of the major protests against the Vietnam movement, the big ones that are remembered in history, and the huge campus protests, every single one of them, I think without exception, takes place in one of three of those nations. I think they all take place in New Netherland, Yankeedom, or the left coast. Very few, if any, even in the Midlands, which you would think would be, and almost none in the locations in the Tidewater and the Deep South, if I recall correctly. They're all concentrated in those places. You know, Students for a Democratic Society were created up in Yankeedom, Berkeley and the Summer of Love and the anti-war movement there, and at NYU, I mean, those were the Kent State took place within that territory as well. So you see enormous regional variations on that. In the 18th century, the idea of, you know, a youth culture or a generational difference where the young will have different values than the older people would have been considered still a very peculiar phenomenon, a very peculiar idea. You know, the world was not thought to change quite as rapidly as we today assume it will change.
Your book is so fascinating to me, and I really wanted to share it with our audience here.
I'm very pleased to have spoken with you, and hope that was useful, and that my roll call of the nations was not too exhaustive for your readers. It's hard to say it any tighter than that and have it be meaningful.
Do you also, your book is available through Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon should be in, Barnes & Noble's everywhere, and it's generally should be available in most places books are sold, and definitely Amazon. It's in paperback and hardcover now.
Colin, thanks so much for sharing your book with us here, and I hope if those of you are listening, if you're at all into history, you'd like to hear a little bit more about it, or you can listen to the entire podcast of our program here at our show, yttshow.org. Thanks again, Colin, and I'll let you go.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking today with our guest, Colin Woodard, author of American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. We've tried in this first half hour to talk about the cultures of the eastern portion of the country and the things that led up to the Revolutionary War and how these cultures interacted with each other then, or didn't interact, as we've found. And next week we'll be talking about the remainder of the cultures as they went into the South and into the West. So I do invite you to come back next week for part two as we talk about the regional cultures of our country. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.